He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3, as they are every Monday for All Revved Up, are Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist. Emmett Price, professor of music at Northeastern University. Great to see you both.
Thanks for having us back.
Hello. Thank you for coming in. So right before you came in, we played the clip from Vintage Saturday Night Live with Richard Pryor. Some pretty raw language going back and forth there, and we were discussing whether or not it would be played today on the major Saturday Night Live. This was, of course, the Vintage Saturday Night Live. It bothered me, even with all the caveats we said before, but maybe I'm crazy. Could they get away with this on Saturday Night Live in 2000?
And should they?
Well, I mean, you know, it happens on public radio in terms of rap music and whatnot, in terms of the language and whatnot. I don't think it's necessary in 2014 like it was in 1975 when that clip hit. I mean, you're coming off the end of the Civil Rights Movement, the assassination of Dr. King. The black community is looking for some kind of leadership and not finding it. The white community, who were trying to figure out what their response was and how they were going to move towards this kind of, desegregation or integration, looking for, leadership, and it wasn't there. And so you have these comedians who step up, particularly Richard Pryor, who was known for his satirical addressment of race and racism. Yeah. I mean, the clip that you played was a job interview. It was a job interview.
Yeah. Yeah, but who said the objectionable words? Not Richard Pryor. Chevy Chase.
That's right. And so here's this response from him teaching black America how to respond in real time when this happens in real life. The kind of, don't stand down, stand up. And at the end, he gets the job, and not only does he get the
vacation.
He got a vacation starting off and got the salary that he wanted.
Oh, it's a brilliant, timeless skit. I do think that if it were played today, it would be taken in the same light, received in the same light as it was back in the day for a couple of reasons. The brilliance is really the technique that is employed. Richard Pryor could say stuff and do stuff that normally would be received as offensive, but he was very, very good at his use of double entendre and racial ambivalence here. And so who's the racially ambivalent character? Well, both of them. Here is, the white guy really this is what he sees when this black guy sits down. And then there's the tentativeness with Richard Pryor. Now, what should I say? Should I be candid? And over a number of this sort of back and forth with the wordplay, it just lets loose. Both of them just let loose.
You know, Jerry Seinfeld called Richard Pryor the Picasso of our profession just because he was so clever in terms of how he did stuff. He had a skit, I think back in the 70s, called The First Black President.
That's right.
And the irony of that skit, that he goes through this whole, production of being, elected the president, and then he's doing his first press conference, and these questions are fired at him, and he's real dignified until you get to this real one question on race or whatnot, and he loses it the same way that he loses it in his job interview.
And it's interesting, the influence that he's had on people like, of course, Eddie Murphy, Chris Rock, Lawrence Martin, Dave Chappelle. Interesting thing is that as brilliant as they are, they're not able to capture Pryor in the way in which he's able to sort of have both sides of the fence, black as well as white, really reexamine their assumptions, whether internally as well externally. There's a group, though. There's a couple today that does that brilliantly, too. They're biracial, and they're called Key and Peele.
But again, let me tell you something. You mentioned Eddie Murphy. I think it was Eddie Murphy. Was it not Eddie Murphy who did the other brilliant routine about race, another brilliant routine? Wasn't Eddie Murphy who, as a black guy, goes to apply for a loan at a bank? Mm-hmm. He's got every. Is it what Eddie Murphy?
Okay. Yeah, that's
he's got everything in order. And he's, you know, he's doing fine financially. He clearly should get the loan. And they say, I'm sorry, you can't, sir. Mm-hmm. He then goes on a bus. The whole, all white people, a public bus. As soon as he gets on the bus, they're quiet. And then I believe he puts on whiteface, doesn't he?
That's right.
He goes in to get the loan from the same guy. He's got nothing. He's bankrupt. He's whatever. And the loan officer starts taking piles of cash out of the drawer and throwing them at him. And when he gets on the bus, when the black guy gets off, the white people stand up and start dancing and having a party. I mean, it was so funny,
but you know, the interesting thing about that, where none of them that I just mentioned are able to carry on the kind of
Pryor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you don't see Richard Pryor in his history of comedy wearing white face. He's able to do it again with the way in which he nuances words, with a kind of he embodies
the expressions on his face.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Were so
but he
funny.
Carries the kind of angst that we carry, both blacks as well as whites.
Mm. Which made him the perfect choice to be the first African-American to guest host Saturday Night
Live.
Was
he? I didn't know.
He was the first one.
Yeah.
And really led the path to Eddie Murphy coming on and many others.
But you know what's amazing? I'm sorry, Murphy.
I was going to say, when you think about it, though, the whole kind of, you know, racial discussion we're never going to have because we never seem to have it. We always say we're going to, we never do. Think about how much comedians, I think, have sort of how important they've been, you know, whether it's Chris Rock. I mean, maybe it's not Richard Pryor.
Or someone very different, like a Bill Cosby. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of them have their unique style of addressing race that is appropriate from the time in which they appear, which is interesting because Key and Peele are important today in a way. Clearly, if we go back in time, first of all, nobody would want them. They're biracial. So what would be funny? You know, what could they possibly conjure up that would be funny? But they have this wonderful character called Luther. I don't know. Which is the president's anger translator, that played by Keel, who works to interpret the president's sort of low-key, measured statements into a raging tirade. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's just funny. Luther is where you clearly see and Emmett will sort of chime in with me of wearing the mask, because here is a very low-key kind of Obama saying, well, we didn't pass a bill today in Congress because given how divided we are. And then you got Luther who say in all sort manner of explicatives explain why the bill did not get passed.
Well, by the way, the one thing you left out on Key and Peele, who did a star turn that was epic. This year. Either of you watch Fargo, which we've discussed a lot.
They
play the two stupid FBI guys who a mass murder goes on like 15 feet away from, and they were brilliant. They were both.
Yeah.
You know, one last thing. I often say to Marjorie, you know, you got to watch such and such a movie. And Marjorie will say, what is it? And I tell her she watches it. And she said, Jim, I watch it because you told me to. It's the most outdated thing ever. This routine that we just played from Chevy Chase and Richard Pryor, 40 years ago was made.
Yeah.
They could do it Saturday night on Saturday Night Live if Pryor was still around. And it would be just as poignant and powerful. It's really unbelievable. Okay, so Irene, for you, we have developed a new feature. We now have a name for it. It's called the Francis Watch. We're going to be doing this.
Thank you.
As in the leader of the Catholic Church.
Oh,
it's the Pope.
Goodness.
Now, we have two items on the Francis Watch this week. Margie, would you like to start that off?
Yeah, well, Francis has gone on the criminal justice system. He blasts Supermax prisons as a form of torture. He wants improved prison conditions. He doesn't think anybody should be in jail for life. He's become
it's a hidden death penalty, a life sentence is
what
he called
right. It. He doesn't like detentions without trial. I didn't realize this, that more than half of all detentions, that means those are detentions without trial are what detentions are in half of the countries around the world. He says the penal system operates like a net that, quote, catches only the little fish while leaving the big fish free to swim the ocean. And he talks about corruption. I mean, he's really kind of denounced the whole, he calls it penal populism. So this is a pretty tough critique of the penal system.
Yeah, and you know what? I you want me to upgrade him from a 2.0 to
yes,
what?
Yes, we do.
Well, it's up to you. We're not telling you what to do.
Well, it stays the same, and I'll tell you why. I think this is really wonderful. What he's doing is sort of employing something called restorative justice, this whole idea, understanding that the penal system is in many ways very, very bogus and biased, understanding that, you know, we want to make a difference between, you know, teaching, you know, ruining a life and teaching teaching a lesson. But, you know, I need to say this, and I've said it numerous times. When it comes to women, we're still – they are in – how about this? They are in an ecclesiastical prison. So if he's about prison reform – he needs to do something about this issue. May I just, I just have to expound a tad on this, okay, particularly about women. There is this sort of magazine out. It's called Fidus. Are you familiar with it, Marjorie? It's
spiritual
a missionary.
Columnist for the Globe.
Okay. Well, anyway, in 2012, it said that nuns were down by 10,677 people worldwide, where the majority of them, 9,051, come from European countries. And the only place where there was a rise in nuns was in African countries and in Asian countries. So I think it's really wonderful that he's right to speak out about the penal system. He even made a statement about Ferguson, which I loved it. I loved it. And it was on the Vatican website. And he said here, in this year dedicated to following this remarkable city at Ferguson, he says he encouraged participants to turn towards God, to the truth, and to the highest good. And I thought that was fabulous. Absolutely. He gets it. Boy, does he get it on so many issues. And it just troubles.
2.75 maybe now?
No, not at all. It stays at 2.0.
You know, I think, let me tell you, Emmett, the reason I was impressed by this is, one, he didn't do the usual caveat that a lot of criminal justice reformers do, say a lot of people serving life sentences who were wrongly accused and convicted. He's not talking about that.
That's right.
He's talking about people who've done the worst kinds of crimes,
right.
have
right.
not gotten the death penalty, but have gotten whatever he said. What did I say a minute ago? A living death penalty or whatever it is by being in jail for life. That really, I can't imagine anybody else on the planet of stature speaking to that constituency. And I don't think it's at all because he doesn't care about victims and their families. But he talks on a level that virtually nobody else has the courage to do.
I think he exemplifies what it means for your life to be the best sermon that you've ever preached. And he is walking the ideology and the philosophical approach to compassion and love for all humankind. He's walking it. So for him to
Come on, you gave your poll.
It's my turn for election here.
Let me see if I can get some votes here.
To go to the least of these and to care enough to advocate on their behalf, the folks who everyone locks in the dungeons and leave them behind, to advocate for them shows his sense of compassion. And so I agree with Irene.
It's selective compassion.
Well, it's selective compassion. Thank God there are no nuns down in the basement. I mean, so he's not saying only the males in the basement, right? Everybody down there. So, I mean, I think this is where we got his
statement. This is bad theology. This is really bad theology. You know, compassion is not selective. That's number one.
I agree.
Compassion, the root of compassion is inclusion, is really inclusion.
What are you saying?
Because
women can't be priests, we can't take this seriously? Is that what you're basically saying?
Of course we need to take this seriously.
Yes,
but
Marjorie, that's what she's saying.
Okay.
No, but you're saying it's such a hole in his resume.
That's right, absolutely.
That everything else pales by comparison. Absolutely. I don't think that's an ridiculous point of view.
And we agreed.
Well,
okay?
To a point. It's a huge issue.
We're commenting on active steps, not inactive steps, right? So the inactive steps are reasonable.
This is the bad theology because, see, you're coming from this place of really restorative justice and the beloved community. And it's the whole idea of this, and I will recite Martin Luther King. What affects one affects us all.
Agreed.
Okay? And that his lens can be far more expansive than just looking at selective issues that in many ways pertain to a particular gender.
Agreed.
So then when the election is over,
let's get the Pope in here so we can interview him to see how he
women,
really feels.
There are women in prison too.
Exactly.
I think he's talking about the feet of women prisoners, if you recall.
I'm a woman too, Irene. I think that this is...
But you know what, though? But see, those women in prison, to me, again, represents the... In many ways, not only women in the... It represents the way in which women are handcuffed to not only a patriarchal system, but to this ecclesiastical prison of what we believe Pope is espousing in terms of, you know, I'm including everybody.
I agree that we need female bishops and female priests. I'm with you on that, and I see where you're going. But that doesn't exclude the fact that the people who he's focused on now are both male and female.
Okay, we're going to make one more try on the Francis watch today. Now, the good news is this is only a tone set by Francis. It's not his actual deed. There's a new incoming bishop out there in Chicago, and he has decided not to live. I assume this was a typo at first. It's not. In the $14.3 million Cardinals mansion.
It's pretty swank.
And instead, he basically, you know who led this trend, brother? It was not Pope Francis. You know who it was?
I think it was Sean O'Malley.
It was Sean O'Malley who decided not to live at, was it Lake Street or wherever
Lake
it is?
Lake Street.
Yep. So,
Commonwealth Avenue and Lake Street.
How about this one?
Listen, give me a break here. You know, it's very interesting. So he decided not to be what he's been and what his brethren have been, which are ecclesiastical pimps, living large on you know, the small coffers of its parishioners. Give me a break. It's not cool. It doesn't have a kind of cachet now to be living large and in light of how the Pope lived.
The Bishop of Bling was, what's the country
okay.
was the Bishop
Germany.
Of Bling? Germany.
Okay.
He was
I love that.
It.
All right. Yeah, it's not good time to be a Bishop of Bling,
okay,
is the bottom line.
That gilded era is gone, and so too now is the bling bling theology that we're moving to. What you and Emmett embrace is this whole notion of an inclusive, a selectively inclusive theology.
I was with you a couple of minutes ago. Why am I being shoved into a chamber with the two of them?
Just because,
I was trying to help you out.
Merely because you stand beside Emmett.
So, Emmett, okay. We'll go to you. What's your take on this?
I mean, you know I'm an eternal optimist. I believe that any move progressively from my theology, not Irene's, is a move in the right step. For this cardinal to not live in this $14.3 million mansion shows that we're making some progress in terms of focusing on
the
things
that are
real.
People. Oh, please, it's no progress. We're shaming people. Now, if the tide should turn and say, listen, Bling Bling is in again. You belong in that mansion. Oh, he'd walk in there easily.
Well, you know where he's living instead, by the way? Did you read this? He's living in a $3.6 million house that the rector of the Trinity Church in Boston
is living in. Okay, see, my case is, okay, there you have it. Really?
Well,
really.
I think there's a positive step, Irene. You are tough, man.
Yeah,
you are
really
tough. I think there's a positive step.
But that's what
steps.
Gets action, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
There's
I agree.
There is a value
2.0. That's all I have to
say. Okay, fine.
He didn't go up on my rector scale.
Now, Irene Monroe, there was a protest on Newbury Street.
Oh,
I was
yeah.
naive enough to think the only protest ever on Newbury Street was people upset because they couldn't find a parking spot. But there was actually a protest about something that matters. The slogan or the hashtag Black Lives Matters. What was that all about?
Oh, I walked into it, and how I walked into it is because
by
I was,
chance.
Yeah, because I was going to the Boston Book Fair, and I wanted to go see Doris
Kearns Goodwin.
Right, and
yeah,
so,
she's going to be with us this
week,
right?
Yeah.
Well, she was at Trinity Church, and I'm at Emmanuel Church. I had it at the wrong. I was at the wrong place, and I happened to see all these cops and stuff, and I'm thinking, wow, she is that big and important. Absolutely, here. And interestingly, while we laugh at that, interestingly enough, one of the people that was sort of watching this crowd gather of African American men and women, and then of course you had the cops all around and stuff. So you began to see a kind of menacing tension escalating. And one woman mentioned, and I guess she felt unfiltered, said to me, she says, "Well, why can't you folks, you know, take your protest somewhere else?" And I said to her, first of all, I'm here at the book festival like you are. that's number one. And interestingly enough, you know, because she went on to say, well, on such a Tony street as Newbury, why would anyone, and you have these pricey restaurants and pricey stores, why, for God's heaven, would you have a protest? She felt, and then she went on to say, unabashedly, you know, to say, you know, there have been plenty other places. She said you could have gone to Boylston Street to have
so
this
what
protest.
Was the point of this protest?
Well, the protest was Ferguson. It was the whole idea of you know, in solidarity not only with Ferguson, but it didn't devoid them of the kind of policing that certainly goes on in Boston. There have been a number of articles in the Globe, the Herald, as well as the Cambridge Chronicle.
Well, the Civil Liberties Union.
That's right.
Study. By the way, I believe the police chief of Boston is going
to
be in tomorrow.
We'll be able to ask
we'll talk
him
about
all
that.
This.
You know, one of the things, we had Cornel West here in here last week, and I'll tell you, talk about a half hour. The
Black prophetic fire.
Well, he is unbelievable in many a way. But, you know, I was doing my usual, and I stole this sort of from Marjorie years ago, no one protests anything anymore. I mean, the reality is, other than that huge thing, that climate change rally for 2 days in New York City, and obviously ongoing things in Ferguson, he had a much more positive attitude, not unlike you, Emmett Price, that all these local demonstrations actually matter. So my initial inclination in my response is Black Lives Matter. What, 100, 125 people? You know, what's the big deal? Mm-hmm. Are you of the Cornel West philosophy that all these local activist things actually add up to something someday?
They matter tremendously. Because on one hand, they weren't just black people who were out there. They were people of different hues, ethnicities, mm-hmm. beliefs, genders, expressions, different types of people who were there in solidarity with the event, making a stance. And then the point that they picked Newberry Street during brunch hour, of all places, I know how you guys love brunches.
I do love brunch.
is that they said that it's important to make a note that things cannot continue as they usually do. And Newberry Street is a place where people go to get lost. To go get lost in the accoutrements of life, to go get lost in, you know, the higher economic status and whatnot. And so them blocking off Newberry Street called attention to a population of people who probably don't usually
care. And stopped business. Yeah, it stopped business. And interestingly enough, you know, if you have just two blacks, you know, it raises concern.
There have been blacks on Newberry Street before the protest, you know that?
I was certainly there.
But you were there by mistake. You were looking for the book fair.
You were lost yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But there's a kind of social and cultural unrest where you see different pockets of groups of people really trying to do coalition building. So if the Ferguson thing in many ways move us forward to addressing the kind of overall social unrest that we're experiencing, these are why these people are here. What we're looking for is what is that turning point that sort of Malcolm Gladwell talks about. What will be that spark? A couple of times we thought it would be Trayvon Martin. We also thought it would be Michael Brown, the Ferguson case. Mm-hmm. We are still searching, and part of that has to do with, in many ways, the paradigm in which we do unrest. It's good in many ways to pull some of the pages from the civil rights movement, but yet again, we have to have a movement where we understand the need to make these connections. We don't make the connections, so you'll have a group of people who will come out for racial justice, but you don't have the LGBT folks coming out saying that this ties to transgender rights. We don't have the folks who are into climate change saying, yes, what's going on racially also is tied to climate change.
Well, by the way, that was Naomi Klein was here the other day, who's sort of been one of the leaders in the whole climate change and other economic, mm-hmm. Progressive economic movements. Her line in her book is exactly yours, is that her hope is the climate change movement is not going any longer to be a movement of environmentalists, mm-hmm. but everybody is going to realize what impact it's having on them.
You have to look at this real quick, that this Black Lives Matter movement that happened on Newberry Street happened because of Facebook.
Yeah.
And Facebook, you're connected to people who are in your own sectors and who are your own, you know, parts of life. So when you use social media as a mechanism for communicating and building the masses, you are going to miss certain segments.
Not necessarily, because the thing about Facebook is that, you know, you Facebook with different coalition groups here.
But these are young people.
Yeah, that too. And they I hate to be cliche-ish, but they are definitely our future. I think the issue is that we're trying to find a linchpin that has so many tentacles that spreads out so that it ties issues around immigration, climate change, racism, policing, women not being, hey, popes in the church. Come on, Marjorie, work with me, okay?
Well, I think there's a theme here. And I think the takeaway from Irene here is that you can't say anything unless you're going to include not just the prisons, but the LGBT community and ageism and
sexism. But if there was any other institution in the world that was excluding women from anything else that we were talking about, your position would be the exact same as hers, right?
Well, there's a lot of religious institutions that exclude women.
No, I'm saying outside of religion. In the world. If there was any movement or any institution that was inclusive with one exception, half the people can't participate.
So my caveat to you, Marjorie, is that as a practicing Catholic,
so
I say this to you.
What?
You got to make the distinction between blind obedience and reasoned faith. And really, and in using reason, faith.
Yeah.
And the Pope says to this, he says, we're open. He says, don't be afraid of new ideas. So here's a man that has a prophetic message, yet very selective in how he employs that. But following this whole notion.
You do know, Irene, that most Catholics pay no attention to what the Pope says about anything.
Well, he doesn't want cafeteria of Catholics.
Yeah, I think he does. I think this is what all this is about. He wants the cafeteria people on the other side of the thing.
2.0.
Anyway,
I give him a 2.25.
Okay,
good to see you both.
Okay.
See you.
Okay, Irene is a syndicated religion columnist. Reverend Emmett Price, and Irene's a reverend too. They both are. It's a professor
on a
of
good
music.
Day.
That's right. At Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and the Hip Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thanks, Irene, and thanks, Emmett, for being here. Up next, it's our final ballot question explainer. Question number 3 in repealing the casino law. Stick around for that debate. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.